Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts. We appreciate it. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to think that you are a hater. This is our day where we talk to a guest that I am pleased to have with us. He is the CEO of Glitch. He's also a big Prince fan and like new Prince, and that makes me so incredibly jealous in every way. And I'm told, Anil Dash, that you're into mangoes.
I'm a fan.
I believe, yeah. I've been told you're a little more than a fan.
All right. It's a little deeper than that. But, you know, it starts, like, you don't want to go too hard right at the top.
I'm curious, though. Like, how do we get to the depth of the affection for the mango?
Well, you know the comedian Hari Kondabolu?
Yes.
He did a great routine on this, which is that, you know, for all Indian folks and South Asian folks, like, mango is this, like, almost spiritual thing. And part of it is what folks don't know, especially in America, is like, there's a million different kinds, right? It's not like that's one fruit. It's like saying apple. Like,
right.
Oh yeah. Okay. There's a million different kinds of apples. But it is like, it represents, like food always does, it's family and it's home and it's your region, right? It's all about like where you're from and like that's almost your team is what your mango is. So like there's a lot in it. It's identity. It's yourself. So, yeah. But, yeah, it's a fruit that I like.
You know, I never considered where mangoes come from until right now.
See?
I'd never thought about that one time. I still need to meet Hari. We were supposed to meet a while ago, because I want to talk to him about
good people.
Yeah, I want to talk to him about the movie, which I found to be the Trouble with Apu, right? I found it to be fascinating in a way that I hadn't, like, my parents work at black colleges, and there's a heavy South Asian professorial population there. And what I realized that, and also when I was watching Hasan Minhaj's special, is that I know your parents.
Yeah.
But I didn't go to school with South Asians, so I don't know, like, that experience. And so it was very interesting seeing, like, that juxtaposition of what Apu kind of represents versus a life that suddenly dawned on me. It's like, you know, I actually don't know anything. I don't have that that cultural experience, that exchange with South Asians of my generation.
Yeah, and there's such a disconnect, too, because, like, you can say, like, HBCUs have got, you know, Indian professors, South Asian professors, whatever, but this is a classic story, but like we don't know our history post-immigration.
Right.
Which is almost this inverse of, you know, what I think a lot of the black experience is, right? It was like, you know your story here and there's this disconnect before, right?
Right.
Before America. And like our story is all about everybody that came on the plane, you know, and then all of us that are here that grew up that are like Americans are totally disconnected from it. And then, I mean, there's such a long history that I think people don't know of how, you know, black and Indian communities have connected for 100 years. Cause 100 years ago, where was an Indian person going to live when they came to America?
Right.
There's only one place. There's only one neighborhood, you know, and I don't think people know that there's that 100 years of history. So I think about that a lot. There's just so much potential there.
Also, depending on your complexion as an Indian person, not only would you be living with the black people, it is entirely possible you may have been considered one of us.
Oh, yeah, 100%. I mean, you know, my father came in 1963, and so, you know, when he was working in the South, he was straight up living in, you know, Jim Crow conditions, and he didn't know. Like, he wasn't fluent in it, and nobody had sort of told him. So I remember him telling me a story when I was a kid where he was like, I went to go get my hair cut, and it was, you know, apparently a white salon, and he's like, they're like, we can't cut your hair here. And he's like, you don't know how to work scissors? Like, what's the deal? You know, like, he just didn't know. And I'm just like, man, you're lucky you didn't get killed.
Right.
You know?
Well, imagine being the person trying to explain this.
Right,
like,
exactly.
Okay, so here's the thing.
So you're new here.
Well, there's all kinds, like, there are things that no matter what you do that, like, when you're in them, it becomes so commonplace you don't think about it. Mm-hmm. And then you need to go, like, college football is an example.
Yeah.
When I have to go explain to people how this works, and they're like, wait a minute, so
seriously?
You're saying they don't get paid?
Right?
Like, you're saying they do all this and nobody gets any money?
Nobody,
they're like, wow, you know, now that you mention this,
this
sounds patently absurd.
Exactly. Like, I want to see that guy's PowerPoint presentation for that barber who's like, now here's how it works here, you know? And I always come back to that as this reference point. And the other thing I think about a lot is, you know, the first wave of Indian immigrants, very, very early, they were traders and, you know, people like doing barter and that kind of stuff. And they settled in Treme in New Orleans.
Okay.
And in Harlem. There's a great book on this called Bengali Harlem. And I'm like, you know, there's all this beautiful history and all this like rich, you know, cultural context, but I just come back to, man, how good was that food?
Yes.
That must have been unbelievable.
Right, like right, an Indian New Orleans hybrid. First of all, sounds like it'll blow your ears. But also the idea that, like, we joke a lot about this show that I always think about guys from Europe who come and their foray or the way they get into America is via the NBA.
Yeah.
Like, what a fascinating way to get into American culture. Learning America from New Orleans.
Yeah.
That's got to be, that's a version. Stuff.
Yeah, that's a real thing. Yeah, and I come back to that too, because that's where, you know, my people in India are from, the East Coast, but it's the Louisiana of India. So it is like, you know, by the water, we got these great dishes with the shrimp and the rice. We got great music. We got great food. And also nobody gets out because everybody's too poor to get out. And, you know, and it's just really, I just think of that, like, these connections that go over, you know, around the world and over centuries and are completely invisible to us now.
You know, there's so much, like, this has just had me thinking about, but just kind of like the role that, like, India plays in the consciousness that we have. Cause I think in America, there's a great fascination with China. You hear about a whole lot more people saying they're jumping on planes to go to China rather than jumping on a plane to go to India, which is interesting because we were talking about the same kind of massive population, you know, same role regionally in a lot of ways. And like history wise, you know, with India not becoming independent until the 20th century, but even still, that independence is around the same time as we start seeing China become more open and less walled off. And it's interesting. Yeah, we talk a lot more about one than we do about the other.
Well, and it's, you know, it's what's visible. And also, I mean, you know, I think China's being more nakedly imperialistic globally. So, like, they get that attention for that. But, yeah, I mean, there is this narrative where, like, you know, for me, it's just, it's family. You know, it is so personal. And, you know, my parents were both born in India, obviously. My dad was not born a free man. He was born in India pre-independence. He's still alive.
Right.
This is living history, right? And he was born a British subject. Like, that is wild. And, you know, and, you know, he's like, yeah, we had fireworks in the village the day that, like, they were independent. He's like, I didn't know what it meant. You know, like, cause he's a little kid. And so, like, that idea of, like, that history of, like, lived colonial experience is alive today. And we don't talk about it and we don't talk about the connections. And, you know, and then my very personal family history, like on my mom's side, like my dad was, you know, whatever, tiny village, poor folks, like all this stuff. My mom's family was like pretty established. And my great grandfather on that side, he marched with Gandhi. And so, you know, the lens I had on even the civil rights movement here in the U.S. was, you know, and it's always the, like, it comes back to family. It's like, you know, well, you know who Martin Luther King was influenced by, right? You know, right. And it's like, it's got to be that Gandhi connection. It's got to be like, in Asian culture, it's always like, we invented that. Right. We invented that, right?
Everybody loves to say they were the OG.
Exactly, right. You know, and I'm like, you know, I don't think that's the point of the civil rights movement, but like, if you want to, you know, if you want to get the producer credit on there, like, okay, well, we'll go there.
That is one of the best things about it. Everybody's got the, well, you know, it goes back to, like, no matter who it is.
100%.
Well, the same way is like, my favorite is black people in the United States who themselves have not listened to anything that is close to rock music in their particular lifetimes.
Yeah.
But I tell you something about Chuck Berry. You know, like we, just before you get this twisted, you know, we started this gangster.
Well, we got the same thing too. Like, Indian folks, same story of like, you know, we were kings, we were queens. And I'm like, wasn't everybody was a king and a queen? Somebody was doing the work.
I'm so glad to hear somebody else say that because, like, you know, my parents, I would not describe them as like Pan-Africanist per se, but there's definitely an influence of that, you know, in the lives we had. And the kings and queens stuff is really, really, really big. Like, I took my buddy Pablo with me in Atlanta last weekend. We drove around and he saw somebody buy the final call and had no idea what the final call was.
Oh, wow.
And I was
All right.
So I was like, oh, lots of educational moments
here
to be had. But the kings and queens always said, by definition, we can't all be kings and queens. That would make this the king family reunion. This ain't happening.
I mean, the thing is, you know, I respect it because you have to build people up and you have to give them a sense of history and you have to tell them you matter and you're somebody and you come from greatness. And I have nothing but respect for that and I appreciate that. But I do, I'm like, listen, somebody was like milking the cows. Somebody was cooking the meals and it wasn't the king.
Right.
You know,
like
somebody was doing this.
And they weren't too fond of the king.
No.
Just to be clear.
Yes, exactly. Well, yeah. And so, but you know, I think there is that sense of, a shared history, a shared context, a common connection that folks don't know. And it's, you know, it's been on my mind lately thinking about Kamala Harris, right?
Yeah.
And like, you know, whatever, like you can get into a lot of policy and all that stuff with her. But what her history is a story America does not know.
Yes.
You know, and that's just interesting to me. And the fact that whatever happens with her campaign, with people's, you know, evaluating her policies, all the platform, all that stuff, they're going to be reckoning with, I did not know there was a story of Black America and Indian America that is not mediated by white media and white experience and white culture that is we're going to have to reckon with on its own. That's like thrilling and exciting to me.
Yep. And then the next level will be when they find out about the Chinese Jamaicans.
Yes.
Which I admit I did not know about until 2014.
Yeah.
And now I'm just kind of low key fascinated by the
idea. Yeah. Yeah. And those things of just like there were interactions and intersections that just didn't happen through top down. And like I said, that mediation of white culture. And it's like, I think that's such a, well, it's unavoidable because it's so big. It's millions of people. It's in interesting parts of culture. I think that's a conversation long overdue.
So much. Like, I'm really glad to, like, have you here and to talk about this. And I'll tell you the first reason I wanted to have you on with us, which is we do a segment on this show called If You Haven't Heard. And we take news stories from around. And basically a recurring theme has become how afraid I am of the future.
Yeah.
Technology is kind of scaring me to death. The tech companies are kind of, like, scaring me to death. And a big thing that you're about is a more ethical, a more friendly sort of tech. And, like, so when – in your mind, like when you say more ethical and more friendly in those ways, like what kind of things are you talking about?
So there's a broad range of things and they tie into a couple themes. I think the starting point is how does this company make its money?
Right.
If they succeed, and these companies, you know, the big tech companies are the most successful companies in the history of the world, so they're doing all right. If they succeed, what happens to the world and where do they make their money? And it's a thing where we can say – we sort of throw them all in a bucket. It's Google and Apple and Facebook and Microsoft, whatever they are, right? But they're all real different, right? Apple, you know, you actually have a pretty good understanding of your relationship with Apple. You buy the phone, they give you the phone, that's it.
It's a hardware company.
Yeah, exactly, right. And the rest of the stuff is to make that a nice experience, but that is the trade that you're making. If you buy a laptop, you buy a phone, that's what they're giving you and you know, whatever. And if you buy something off of iTunes. And, you know, I can object to the conditions of the workers that are building the phones. I can object to this is an extractive industry using rare minerals and these kinds of things. But I have a fundamental understanding of what their impact is on the world. And in fact, when they say I'm using less arsenic in the glass, I'm like, okay, good. That's a thing you can measure and understand. Then you take Google and Facebook, and they are also extractive, right? But it is about as much possible information about as many people in the world as they possibly can. And it's not really possible to consent, right? With Apple, if you don't go to the Apple store, you don't go to their website and you buy something, you don't have a relationship with them. And that's very easy to understand. If you say you had a Gmail account, you're like, I don't feel good about Google anymore. I'm going to close it. Well, everybody else you're emailing still has Gmail. So they still have all your messages, right? And if you say, I don't like where Facebook is going, I'm going to close my Facebook account, and you're still on Instagram, they still have all your data. And in fact, I think with those companies, they're so good at machine learning, artificial intelligence, those things, that if you closed your account, they could probably form a profile about you based on the absence of you, like the silhouette, the shadow of where you were and what people say about you, to form enough of a data profile to know a lot about you, including, you know, probably what are your political views, geographically where you're located, what kind of things do you buy. And that to me feels like once you cannot consent – and you cannot have a reasoned relationship with, like, this company is choosing to do these things with me and my personal information, you've changed the game. You're in a different land. And that is fundamental to how they make money. And so if you say, well, the only way we're going to keep growing and keep being the richest companies that have ever existed is if we keep pulling more and more and more data out of you, something's got
to
give.
You know, and Facebook to me is interesting because – the game that they were playing, and I guess Google in a similar way, but really with Facebook, Facebook played a game where in the end there could only be one winner, right? Mm-hmm. Because Facebook's greatest advantage, I think, and the reason it's so hard for a lot of people to leave is everybody's there.
That's right.
Like you can't jump ship. Somebody sent me a beta version of some social network and I was like, sure, I'll give it a try. And there are like 17 people on it right now. And unless everybody goes there, like that's the greatest advantage that you have to being there. there's no tearing that down, right?
That's right.
There's no chipping away at that point. And so, boom, once that happened, you go here because everybody goes there. It's almost like smoking cigarettes. You do it because you used to.
Yeah.
And now, boom, you are in. And I think what happened for so many people also was just kind of a fundamental misunderstanding of the nature of what these businesses are, because
yes,
Facebook to you is your page.
Right.
And I don't know when it dawned on me, like, oh, wait a minute, they're doing something different here.
And they downplayed it for years. I mean, there's no question that there was almost a misrepresentation of, like, what do we think we're in the business of doing and how does this work? And, you know, that reckoning, everybody has had that realization now. We're like, oh, man, I didn't know. I didn't know what I was getting into. And, yeah, I can't leave. You know, in my case, like, I got family, you know, in India and everywhere else, and they use WhatsApp. And it's almost impossible for Americans to understand how big WhatsApp is globally. Like, it is so central to how people communicate in the rest of the world. And, but certainly we can understand Instagram. And they have all of them. Like, WhatsApp, Instagram, they're all Facebook, right? And they're all getting connected. And in fact, it was such a big deal to connect the messaging of those platforms that the founders of WhatsApp and the founders of Instagram all quit Facebook. One of the dudes on WhatsApp, he walked away from $500 million because
right,
he's like, yeah, I'm not down with this, which is – that's unbelievable, right? Like, that's – and I mean, I guess he's got his other billions to keep him warm, but you still – I mean, $500 million is $500 million.
Right.
You don't do that casually. And so for all of them to say, like, this is intolerable, we can't do this, it's too, you know, dangerous, risky, whatever you want to call it, to combine all these messaging platforms, in this moment where we know those are being abused for – you know, political gain, those are being abused for social gain, there's the misinformation is being spread. You know, that is such a – the stakes are so much higher than when we thought, oh, this is just better than MySpace.
Right. that was – you know, and it was funny because it was a class divide, really.
Yeah.
Between,
oh, yeah,
MySpace and, mm-hmm, Facebook. Like, basically, MySpace were your neighbors with the tacky Christmas decorations.
Yeah.
That's what it was.
Well, no, I think there was a real explicit positioning of Facebook as white flight. 100%, right? Because you looked at the defining names and faces on MySpace, and it was a ton of hip hop. But even when it wasn't, there was a huge Asian American population.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I don't know what Tila Tequila identifies as now, but, like, you know, at some point that was sort of core to what that platform was. And I mean, it's music and culture, which is always going to be, you know, everybody else. And having that, you know, that breadth and that diversity of what they are, you know, Facebook is like, we're this clean, almost sterile environment. But the thing I think about is, you know, founders and visionaries for companies define their identity for those companies. And the purpose that you start out with defines the destiny of what that product is going to be. And Facebook was explicitly created as a private club for members of the Ivy League.
Right.
There's no ambiguity about that. That was actually one part of that movie, The Social Network, that's really true. Right. Which is like, it was a bunch of dudes at Harvard saying, here's our private club and for us to be able to rate women.
Right.
Right. And okay, well, what happens then? Like, what you can, yes, they broadened out, obviously, immensely, immeasurably, unimaginably. But at its core, its DNA, did this start as a private club for Ivy League dudes? 100% it did. And so when you get to the opposite extreme, which is some of the most marginalized poor people in Myanmar that are being fed misinformation through WhatsApp, and you have, you know, as is the case there, a genocide being galvanized by misinformation spread on these platforms. And meanwhile, Facebook has no people on the ground there, no office there. They probably didn't have anybody on staff that could create policy who spoke Burmese. So no fluency in these concerns, and people are dying. That is the worst case scenario of unintended consequences, unexpected results. And ultimately, when they're the ones profiting from that, when all the money that they're making in Myanmar is going in their pockets, they have to be accountable for it.
Now, just to be clear, how is WhatsApp being used for misinformation?
So, first of all, for folks that don't know, WhatsApp, you know, it's a messaging app.
Right.
It's similar to iMessage or whatever else. The first thing they did is they are very popular in the rest of the world because texting, SMS is really expensive. So you pay once. You pay basically like a dollar, and then you got unlimited messaging. So that was radical. And my family had that. You know, rural India, they need to get the price of rice at the market the next town over. All right, just buy WhatsApp, and now you're good forever of, like, getting information. So in, you know, most of the most rapidly growing parts of the world, especially Asia and Africa, this default messaging app. And so that was the sort of starting point of digital mass media. Because people didn't have broad internet access, and this would work on very, like, not quite smartphones, right? So to them, what one of the things that's really, really hard to understand when we grow up with TV and radio and all the streaming media is there had not been really real-time mass media in a lot of the people – in a lot of the regions that these people were connected in, right? So my own family's village, there was basically no TV, no radio, and then like a weekly newspaper. And so the assumption is that this – because it's so high-tech and so modern and such a radical leap forward, it must be true. This must be a source of accuracy. This must be vetted information. And it's coming from the richest man in the world, right, as far as they know, right? Like, I mean, Zuck's not, but, like, this is the perception, right? Is right. The way out is you become a programmer and you go and you work for Bill Gates or Mark Zuckerberg. And so if one of the richest people who's ever lived provides one of the most high-tech platforms you've ever seen, then the information is instantly credible. And then you have people cynically manipulating that, right? So you have leadership in Myanmar and Sri Lanka and other places that are saying – and in America – saying, let me use this channel to spread misinformation deliberately because it will galvanize my base and inflame tensions that already existed for decades. And, you know, the thing they don't understand is that with, you know, social media, digital platforms, yeah, you don't change human nature, but you amplify it, you accelerate it, you make it more intense. And so these things that were long simmering tensions, you know, turn into ethnic cleansing, turn into really, really large-scale violence, tens of thousands of people being displaced. And yeah, like, it's not the fault of the app, no. But can the platform take responsibility for information being shared? Absolutely. And should they have had visibility into this place where they see the growth? They certainly had somebody who was in charge of, let's get more users in that region. And then say, well, what are the implications if we do? And what happens on the ground? What happens to the people who are seeing this kind of real-time information spread for the first time? And what are their responsibilities? That conversation never happened. And then by the time they found out about it from the people working on, you know, human rights violations in South Asia, they had no capability to respond. And that's what I find egregious, because you can't say they don't have the money. You can't say they don't have the resources. If you've got, I'm building a rocket in my free time money. If right. you've got, I'm building a drone money. Then you certainly have, let me find out what's happening to these folks, that are on the wrong end of, you know, government military crackdown. And you get the resource of that too.
Well, it's worth noting also that the building of the legend of Facebook, which there was a great investment in,
oh, yeah.
the, you know, in building the narrative that surrounded it, was that Zuckerberg was creating a platform that could make the world a better place.
Right. And, you know, I think that's a real sincere intent. I don't question him on that. I mean, I haven't talked to Zuck in, I don't know, 10 years, but like, I think he was very sincere early on in wanting to do that, and we all were. I was building social platforms. All, you know, I knew lots of people that were. And, of course you want to help people connect. And we did have a naive belief, myself included, that was like, well, if you connect people, they're just going to – they're going to, you know, discover each other's backgrounds, and they're going to – you know, it's going to be this amazing, you know, learning experience. And, like, some of that is true. I mean, there are times I go on YouTube and I'm like, wow, somebody's got this tutorial on this thing I didn't know anything about. Right. And, you know, that's great. And also, then I finished that video at the end. It's like, you should watch this video with like a white supremacist conspiracy theory, you know? And I'm like, maybe you don't need to recommend that to me right now.
Right.
You know? And so that tension of like, is the positive promise real? Yeah. 100%. Is that idea was going to bring us closer together real? Totally true. Should we have also anticipated and, you know, that there was going to be this negative threat? Absolutely. Because that's the, you know, that is the thing that's incumbent about anybody that makes billions of dollars is to say, well, what is the cost of this?
Yeah. And I guess, you know, some people need to feel like they're alone, right?
Yeah.
I think that's a fair point. Yes. And I think this is something that all of us naively, you know, because we were like the people that we can connect with,
yeah,
and the things that we can get to. And we did not do the math on all these other people who would then suddenly connect. And then, of course, as it relates, you know, to the media and everything else, where everything is being sold to very particular groups. Like, that's why your cable dial can have 500 channels, because there's some very particular group that they've included watches these commercials, you know?
Right.
And so, once you can just sell all this to every particular people, senses of like decency and decorum, and then I guess fundamentally the ethics go away because you're only selling it to people who want it.
Yeah.
So they're not going to be the ones who complain. And so then you come from the outside and be like, hey man, you know, you're out here pushing some stuff that's really a problem.
That's
and they're like,
right.
but they're good with it.
And that's the thing, is there's the passivity to it, which is this, well, if people want it, it must be, that's their choice. That's not on us. We're not responsible. But what you put out there, it matters a lot. And you see this where, you know, so many industries go through this, but you think about food in particular, right? And, you know, Super Size Me came out and all of a sudden McDonald's was selling apples in the Happy Meals.
Right.
Right? Like you can push on the right button and you can change behavior. And all these companies care about their story. I mean, you look at the amount of money they spend. When The Social Network came out and people thought this is going to make Zuckerberg look bad, the day the movie came out, he went on Oprah with Cory Booker and Chris Christie. And said, I'm giving $100 million to Newark Public Schools. And I mean, depending on who you ask, it didn't really have much impact. I certainly don't think you can argue the trajectory of public schools in Newark changed.
Right.
Both Chris Christie and, you know, Cory Booker made certainly a political benefit at the time. I think now they probably are running away from it. but, you know, the emails came out about that whole thing and it was Sheryl Sandberg saying like, look, we got to make this look good because this movie's coming. And for them to drop $100 million like it's nothing, you know, and Oprah to talk about this like, you know, you get a car and you get an education, you know, that's wild to me. Because, like, I'm old-fashioned. I still think $100 million is a lot of money, you know. And it did nothing. Like, it just disappeared. There's no new school there. And the thing is, like, if they'd have built, like, you know, the Zuckerberg School and whatever and all the kids had great resources – all right, put your name on it. That's no skin off my back. I don't care. But the thing to see of like they have that kind of resources and don't even care if they waste it, you know, is a big disconnect. And I had, you know, a reckoning myself, which is like I'd worked on early social media platforms and probably the best known of them was LiveJournal. I worked on that for a couple of years and it was one of the first to reach like millions of users. And you know, I was guilty of all these things. I thought, okay, you put the platform out there. It's not your fault what people do with it. But look, if you connect people, good stuff is going to happen. And we tell these heartwarming stories. All these people like were responding to each other's messages and it turns out they had something in common and they met and they fell in love and isn't that great? And they say, yeah, well, this other one, he's threatening somebody with violence. Well, that's not our fault, right? Like that's just people being people. And then it took a reckoning of realizing, okay, if I'm going to build tools, I'm going to build technology, then I have to think first about the most vulnerable people and what does this do for them and what does this do to them? And I have to start there and work from there to decide, okay, now how am I going to make my money?
All of it is just, you know, because I was a power Twitter user who has kind of evolved and fallen back off of that a little bit because streets got hot. She's got hot. Got to stop being fun.
Twitter comes for us all.
Yeah. It's just like, hey, man, I was like, I had gotten through. You hear me knocking on that wood. I had gotten through without getting into any major, like, thing. And I was like, I would like to keep that streak going as long as possible. Yep. And this is borderline impossible now to do at this point. But I feel like it was an arc for, like, 2009 to me is kind of like when, like, people broke through the wall, especially on Twitter, right?
Yeah, and that's just the inflection point.
Right, and to use that as – you can kind of chart what happened. And I always feel like the change is you went from people using Twitter – famous people use Twitter to act like regular people. And now we're in 2019 where regular people use Twitter to act like famous people.
All right.
Everybody's a brand now.
Yeah.
No matter who it is. You know what the right answers are. There's not a lot of room for nuance because this is a small bite representation of you. So there's no time for you to go off script in any sort of way.
Right.
But I felt like the early part really was everything that we talked about was there was a sharing. And
yeah, there's a moment.
And I don't know if 2016 was the change or whatever, but after that it was man, what happened to the good news?
It certainly didn't help. Yeah, but there's I think every network goes to that early on where there's a moment. I mean, people talk about that with Instagram. And one of the things you see is the stars. They always talk about the platform made stars, the YouTube stars, the Vine stars, whatever it was. RIP Vine. I miss Vine. And what you find is the stars are people that were early. It's not like they're that much better at it. It's like if you were early to YouTube, guess what? You're big on YouTube.
Right.
If you were early to, like me, like I'm not huge on Twitter, but I got a lot of followers for somebody that is like some dude that works in software.
Right.
You know, and it's because I was early. You know what I mean? And so I think that thing of like understanding oh, that's network privilege, right? In my case, it was like, I knew the founders of Twitter. I still do. So like, that was like, okay, yeah, it turns out if you know somebody, you get in and that's how you get over. But that's not, you know, that's being in the right place at the right time and old boys club. That is not merit.
Right.
And we didn't understand that about networks because they are presented as technology. And so, and this still happens in Silicon Valley. People are like, well, we're going to win because we're going to have better photo filters. Man, nobody cares about that. Like, nobody's like, I'm going to leave all my friends behind on Instagram because over here they got this other thing. And I mean, and Snap is feeling that real hard right now, right? Where it's like, they're like, we got better, whatever, put a flower crown on your head for Coachella. And people are like, I don't care about any of that. Like, you know, Kylie said this isn't cool anymore.
Right. Yeah, what do you do? Like, once that happens, right? What do you do?
Yeah.
You
yeah. Do that's thing. Well, and I think most of the tech industry can't process that. They're like, oh, let's throw more tech at it.
Now, I feel like with Twitter, though, as we talk about the companies that appear to be not feeling responsible for what happens on their platform, they seem to be going for the gold in a way that is like really bizarre to me, because I think like Facebook is a utility as much as anything else. Twitter is kind of an experience. And, you know, so like people coming to trash you on Twitter in the ways that they're doing.
Yeah.
It means something different.
Well, Twitter is media, right? And Facebook is not in that way. I mean, parts of Instagram are, but for the most part, Facebook is for sharing media, but it isn't media.
Right.
And Twitter exists in the media sphere. And there's a lot of reasons why, like technically and structurally. But, you know, Twitter's the company I know best out of all the big networks because I know those guys for 20 years, way before they did Twitter, and have known people at the company up and down all the time. It's interesting because there have always been people fighting the good fight there, and they've never had the resources they need, and they've never been taken seriously. And, you know, like first time I met Jack Dorsey, he was like, he had like a nose ring and blue hair and was looking derelict in this park in San Francisco, right, where I used to walk my dog, right? And I was like, who's this guy, you know? And there is nothing that could prepare him from going from that to what he does now, right? And that's not – I'm not like dragging Jack. I'm just like, nobody could do
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it's a switch.
That's just human nature. Like you can't be that other thing. You can't make that leap and have that power. And the worst part about this, anybody ends up in that position, everybody around you is trying to get access to you. Everybody around you is trying to blow smoke up your right? Because they're like, I just want to get over. I want to be part of the halo of this billionaire. And so who's going to sit down with you and be like, you're messing up, man. Like you're doing this wrong. Even internally, people who have done that, you know, that I've known at Twitter, like, and then they're like, okay, I hear you. What if we, you know, we throw some resources your way, we throw you a bone, but it's a structural thing, right? You have to change the dynamics of like, how does this company make money and what do they care about and what's going to, you know, move the needle for what they measure. And this is a publicly traded company. So if you've already set a precedent of like Wall Street is going to look for these numbers to go up, and those numbers going up is like, well, if we kick all the Nazis off the platform, those numbers aren't going to go up. Man, you're in a bad way for a long time. And, you know, I think they are trying to change, but it doesn't like – and the truth of it is they are better at it now. They actually do a better job of suspending accounts. They do a better job of responding to reports. But when you have years of cultural debt, years to pay back of like how we've been screwing up, like it's not going to just all of a sudden go away.
No, I had a point for me where I was like, I no longer know if I'm talking to a person, you know, and I, as someone who likes to volley,
The
haters, it's no fun when I figured out that the haters weren't actually like, I could live with the idea that they were just sitting around, like it was just a person sitting around looking to antagonize. I was kind of okay with that. But then when it just started to feel like not a person at all, like, I was betting on whether or not I was dealing with a human being.
And you know what the worst thing about that is that you didn't know. And part of the reason you didn't know is because so many of the humans, the real humans, non-bots, are acting like they were scripted by a computer.
That is correct.
Right? And because like the bots, it is, that's whatever. Like, I mean, part of it is like, I work in tech. I know how to write a bot.
Right.
You know, so like that doesn't, like, it's bad, but it doesn't bother me because we're like, yeah, of course. Like I mean, they've been writing sci-fi about that for 100 years.
Right.
Right? So, like, we know that problem. What I did not understand was, you know, in my case, somebody's going to jump in my mentions with the eagle avatar and the MAGA hat and whatever, and they're going to say something where I'm like, do you even Like, do these words mean anything to you? Are you just reciting this?
Right.
And that sense. And sometimes, like, they'll crack enough. I'll be like, okay, there's a person in there. And I'll be like, really? Like, you're going to spend your time being like, I want to trigger this dude in New York, whatever. And I'm like, who sold you what bill of goods?
Yeah.
What did they promise you was going to happen if you did this? Like, what in your mind was going to be better for you? And, you know, and I always go to that. I'm like, when they told you that co-signing, calling for the death of the Central Park Five was going to get you somewhere.
Yes.
What were you told? What did you believe? What's in your heart that you think this is going to make things right? And that piece of like, if I hurt you, I'm going to be made whole. Man, anybody who's ever tried that knows it doesn't work.
Right.
You know, like, so that part was like, that was almost too heavy. Like, I had a moment, you know, and I guess after 2016, we all did, but I had that moment where, and I think it was akin to like, we all knew structural institutional racism was this burden that's too heavy for anyone to bear. I didn't understand it as a national security weakness to be exploited by players, both domestic and foreign.
Yes.
Right? Like, that you can count on white supremacy so reliably that you can automate it. Right? Yeah. Right? That the responses are so predictable that you can write primitive software. This isn't hard software.
Right.
This is not the tough part. This isn't like the Google geniuses. This is like kids in like Eastern Europe that are like, hey, let me just try this.
Yeah.
Right?
But if you think about it though, you were in the 1940s, 1950s, and Paul Robeson is saying that,
yes, sir,
you know, black people would not fight a war against the Soviet Union because the Soviet Union has given full citizenship to black people. And I have no reason to believe that the Soviet Union has any love or affection for black people. But that is
it's
an indication of an understanding. And this is part of, you know, part of what pushes the civil rights movement is the Cold War. And it became principally difficult to push the morality on the rest of the world once this happened here. And so there are people who have understood that what is kind of a crack here in this is this animosity.
Like, you look how long the FBI files go on about Muhammad Ali saying no Viet Cong ever called me in, right? You know? And it was such a, it was so clarifying because of all the things he did, this is the one they were mad about, right? You know? And it was like, man, that was the easiest thing in the world for, and you know, and especially because of what Ali represented, right, is literal strength.
Right.
I mean, I think that's such a clarifying moment too.
But like another thing that got me was once I realized like how the trolls were weaponized.
Yeah.
Right? Like, cause to me, it's like, I think I and other people use bot as a term very broad to cover like all this, but when something happens and you look in your mentions and you're like, okay, in the last 6 minutes, I've gotten 7 replies. All from people who don't follow me.
With this phrase.
All basically saying the same thing. Like someone has deployed them and sent them in my direction. Because it's almost somebody's list. They know too many details.
And that the swarming behavior can happen whether it's people or software.
Right.
That's a structural problem in how the platforms are built and the networks are built. But it is a thing that is more dystopian than I'd imagined.
Yeah.
And that even when I started to understand, you know, 10 years ago how the social networks we'd built could be misused and I understood my own complicity in building flaws into them, I did not foresee that.
But like, what flaw do you think that you saw yourself that you built in?
You know, getting away from the technical side at a human level, the first time somebody published our home address was on a platform that I'd helped create. And this was basically when they were building the playbook of what would become Gamergate, which was sort of the perfection of the modern harassment model. And, you know, some of the same folks that were involved in that would sort of had gone for this. And I realized I gave the tools to this guy to do this. And you feel vulnerable because like me, I'm whatever. Like, I don't care what you do to me. My kid, my wife, like it's very, very hard for any normal person to be rational about that. You can't be like, let me assess the seriousness of this. You're like, I want to go get this dude. Like you can't respond in a reasonable way. And so this, like the emotional tenor of it gets ramped up, that the terror or the anger gets ramped up. And to understand that I had gotten played by people talking about the rhetoric of free speech. To say, oh, you have to allow this. You have to allow harassers on because it's free speech. And the reality is, again, if we start from the most vulnerable, the people most at risk, and we say, I care about their free speech. And if I want to build a platform that's about free speech, you say the most marginalized people's speech is what I want to protect, then necessarily I have to stop the harassers and stop the white supremacists and stop the other groups, because they're going to silence the speech. They are the censors. And that if you let them run rampant, you know, it's the same thing happens. Like, a lot of people have said this, but like, if you go into a bar and there's one Nazi in the bar, that's a Nazi bar. It doesn't matter who else is in there, right? Like, it's, as soon as you let one in, it's like, yeah, it's like, oh, there's only one guy in a Klan robe in here. You know what? I'm good. I'm going down the street. Like, I'm good. Like, I don't need to go in there. And so it's not actually like the quantity. It's a binary state. It is a yes or no. It is an on or off. It's like, do you allow this here or not? Because then you, because people say, oh, free speech, you gotta let, you know, you gotta let the Klansmen into your bar. Guess what? You are hurting free speech, because there are most people, including most reasonable people of, and even those who wouldn't be targeted. Most reasonable white folks would be like, yeah, I don't want to be in the bar with the Klans guy.
Right.
You were Klansmen. So like, that thing is this real, I think it was an epiphany about like, what you allow determines what the platform is, and that I had gotten it wrong, and I had gotten played by people who had an agenda of saying, I want to empower these people whose ideas right now are considered unacceptable, but that we can normalize. And that is how the renormalization of overt white supremacy happened.
Yeah, see, I wind up in kind of a tricky place sometimes in those discussions, because I've made peace with the fact that good things happen to awful people.
Yeah.
All the time, yep. Right? Like, it's kind of built into it quietly. It's kind of what makes America great.
Yeah.
It's the idea that in spite of the awful person that you are, you can be successful.
Yes.
At this, like, there's, you know, like I do in ways, while understanding the flaws in the macro system, I do lean toward a certain level of meritocracy. And sometimes mm-hmm. that meritocracy ignores the fact that you may in fact be an awful person.
Yeah.
Like, that's where it is.
And keep in mind that another way to describe some cases of a good thing happening to an awful person is redemption.
Yes. Right. Like, this is what it is. Like,
yeah.
This is the game. I don't expect everything to be fair, in that way. But so, like, when Donald Sterling lost his basketball team, I did not think he should have lost his basketball
all
team
right.
for that.
Well,
like, if you were going to do it, there were other times that it could have been done. But
the right thing happened for the wrong reason.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Like, but just for being like, being ridiculous and saying some things about Magic Johnson, I'm like, nah, mm-hmm. nah, nah. You know, people get to do that all the time. But you don't get to like come throw this out in my face.
Yeah,
like if he had said that stuff at a podium, I would have felt differently. And that mm-hmm. is kind of where the line is for me is.
So not the what, but the how.
Right, right. Like yeah. if you are a Nazi in your heart and soul
mm-hmm.
and you keep it in your heart and soul.
Yeah.
I really can't do anything about
that. No, that's it. And then we had built a social norm around that. We
right.
had said like, look, if you want to go home and be your racist self, that's fine, but you can't do it here.
Right.
And you can't do it in my office, and you can't do it in all these places. And that actually was useful, because what happens when you create those norms is people don't learn it. They don't see it. So there is a generation that had a brief respite from learning that in the public sphere, right? Now, what is interesting is there's an argument that, well, that makes them bitter and it makes them resentful that they can't say what they really think. And I'm like, be bitter then.
Well, yeah, because all this racism is not an indication of bitterness.
Right. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Right. So I'm like, you know what? Like, feel however you need to feel. But it's being used as a justification, right? And so that becomes what do they always call it? The economic vulnerability, right? And
right.
It's like, yeah, you know what? I've seen a lot of poor folks that were black and brown and they didn't become white supremacists.
Right. I know some that have, just to be clear, but yeah, no, but you know, in all of it though, when it like, once, especially when you talk about Twitter, like you're a publicly traded company.
Mm-hmm.
Once you get to a place where whatever amount of money you're making right now is established as that sort of baseline.
Yeah.
It's on, right?
Yeah. yeah
right.
Yeah.
'Cause the only thing the shareholders have in common is this money.
Yeah.
And so hook or crook, you got to go out here and get this money. And the pressure of getting money now that, I think most people signed up and did not think about, I think what's the line is that if you're not paying for the product, you are the product.
Yeah.
That this was not considered in these ways. Like we talk about, we do things with people with like the cameras, you know,
where
like they're just thinking, hey, I'm making sure nobody's walking by my house. And
right.
now somebody is hacking into this because something, you know, there's a gain that they can now somehow get. And that's where kind of all of this got is like, hey man, if you've got to sustain this growth and the growth is from having people, then they're like, hey man, we got to find a way to make some kind of peace with these people.
And you know, what's funny is in the early days, going back 15 years ago now, almost 20 years, early days of social media, advertisers, especially online advertisers, were like, oh, I don't want to be around offensive content. I don't want to be around scary content. They used to call it user-generated content, like early days of YouTube and all that, right? And they were like, I don't want to be on that. What's interesting is there's been this layer, this buffer put in between the brands and the networks where, you know, because it's Coke and Pepsi and you know, whatever you know, companies you want to talk about, Ford and Chevy. And yet you're sponsoring these networks where this awful stuff happens. So you can regularly go on the worst conspiracy theory video on YouTube and the pre-roll video is like, come buy this Chevy truck. Right. And you're like, now, how did they do that?
Right.
And that was where it is about the technology. It is different than what was coming before because they had that abstraction, that disconnection, that layer that gave them plausible deniability. Before, if you see where it's connected, where they're like, Tucker Carlson is saying some white supremacist BS on air, you can call up the advertiser and be like, I saw your ad, you know, whatever company, whoever you are, you put your cookie ad on there. I'm not buying your cookies. And they're like, oh, that's it. We're out.
Right.
And there's Sleeping Giants is one of these groups that's doing this work on like calling out advertisers saying like, is this what you're really about? And it works because TV works that way. What's interesting is that does not happen online because both Google and Facebook have built ad networks where like you buy in this black box and you're just like, just get me people with these traits that have this much income and in this region. And it shows up on this content that is horrible. And you're like, oh, I don't know. I just gave my money to Google. I didn't know what they're doing. That thing, man, that is like, that's like fourth greatest trick the devil ever pulled.
It's also got to be disheartening when you think about what some of those companies are and what some of those videos are. And the company is saying like, give me people that make $120,000.
Yes.
A year. Right. Yeah, like they are not out here trolling for the ungainfully employed and removed from society.
I mean, you see it all these dudes that run, whether it's Proud Boy, I mean, that Proud Boys dude, he lives in like a nice neighborhood in Connecticut, right? Like these are not poor people. And I mentioned this too, where like, you know, I grew up rural Pennsylvania. We were pretty much the first non-white family in our school district. My sister, I have an older sister. She was like the first, she was the only non-white student when she went to school. And you know, it's Trump country, 100%, right? It is red heart. But, you know, I went back for my high school reunion, which is a fun thing to do when you're like CEO of a company and living in New York City. You know, I'm like, yeah, I'm going. Yeah, it's like my sweet 16. I'm going to take the chopper in, you know. But no, I went, and it's like, and the thing is, a lot of those folks, it's good people. Like I'm like, I know you. You know me growing up. I heard stories from them. They're like, listen, they were telling me, like, you're the first glimpse I got of something else, like a different culture, a different whatever. I was like, that's interesting. And they were real thoughtful about it. And they were not diehards. They were not like Red Hat. They were not like, man, this guy, you know, do or die. A lot of them voted for Trump, no question about it. But they're like, you know, that's the team I'm on.
Right.
That's what I do. I'm not down with this guy. But they're not out there in the streets and they are not on. They're like, these people are like, I've never used Twitter. Never seen it.
Right.
Right. Cause like, it's like 10% of America uses Twitter, 12%. It's a small number. Right. And so, They're not in the culture war. They're just sort of like, I thought it would cut my taxes, whatever. I'm not saying it's okay. Like, I still don't countenance, like, you're allowed to be down with white supremacy if you, like, get a tax cut. But I don't think they had malice in their hearts. I think they were thoughtless, you know? But you see the folks who are all in, and they do the grift, like all these, you know, like, interchangeable blonde ladies that are carrying a gun and trying to trigger people. You know, and it's like, that's a grift, man. That is like, that is the oldest, like, that's snake oil, and that's not new. That's American's apple pie. It's been around for hundreds of years. And they're the ones that are like, this is the way I'm going to get over. And they are all six-figure folks. They went to good schools. You know, it's like, I was, you know, years ago, you know, people point out, like, Ann Coulter lives in Manhattan.
Yeah.
You know, like, this stuff is like, for them, it's an act. It's contrived. But they definitely feel like this is their chance to make some money to get over. And that the cynicism of that, leave aside the hate, you know, that they preach or the awful rhetoric that they spout, the cynicism of that, of like, I don't care how I get over as long as I do, is, man, that's what gets my soul. Cause like to know people like hate me because of how I look, like that's always been true. to see people that are like, I don't even care if I hate you, but I don't mind encouraging others to, if that helps me make a dollar. I mean, man, that is poison.
Yeah, no, and the disheartening fact that it can be, or at the very least, perceived to be effective.
Yeah. Right?
Because I've had, like, not to even make it about me, but there's a handful of people who figured out that I served as, like, a representation of something that they believe
yes.
that other people would then hate. They don't hate me, right?
No, right, yeah, you're
right?
a symbol.
Yeah, right. Yeah. They don't hate me. They don't think I'm bad at this. They don't mm-hmm. think any of those mm-hmm. things, but they think that they can get together enough people. And boom, that becomes a hustle.
Yeah.
Right. Like
yeah.
that alone right there becomes a hustle. And it, you know, from my standpoint, there's no one person I could create to do that to. Mm-hmm. Right. It wouldn't work.
That's right. That's right. There isn't the reverse. It's a one way thing. And that's the thing is it comes down to it's easier to tear down than to build.
Yeah.
And when you put yourself out there, you are building something and there are lots of people that can try and tear it down. And they don't have to be able to build. They're not trying to be somebody. That's why they can be anonymous trolls. Is they're like, all I want to do is tear that thing down. I don't care if I ever build anything.
Right.
And the asymmetry of that, I mean, that's guerrilla warfare, right? Like that is a thing that is like, man, you can't mess with people that don't have anything to lose. And
nope.
what they do is they're able to put on a cloak of anonymity that puts them in the position of somebody with nothing to lose and then go back to their normal life.
Yeah. And that to me is actually the great philosophical question of the internet is anonymity.
Yeah. So – I thought a lot about this. So I don't want to get too technical, but I'll sort of cover one thing. So I'm on the board of this company called Stack Overflow, and it is a community that is where every programmer in the world answers each other's questions. And so if you're somebody who codes pretty much anywhere in the world, you know this site. You go there when you're like, I found an error message. How do I fix it? And everybody helps answer each other's questions. It's amazing. It's like Wikipedia. It's one of those things where you're like, this should never work, and yet it works, and
right.
the information is reliable. It's amazing. You know, the wild thing about it is you can be pretty much totally anonymous and ask a question or answer a question. Some people choose to put their name, but most people, they put like those like handles, like, you know, you make up a name for yourself.
Right.
And one thing I've learned is there's a huge difference between anonymity and pseudonymity. Because if you have a consistent name, even if it's fake, stage name, whatever,
right.
that means something to people and that tells people who you are, even if they don't know what your, you know, your government name is and they don't know you in the real world. That's valuable and I think that's powerful and that is also a good encouragement for accountability because at least the reputation of that name, that handle that you picked has some value over time.
Right.
So I'm a real big believer in pseudonymity. True anonymity though – we look in journalism and, I used to work at newspapers and one, anonymity is a thing that you, in only very rare cases, grant somebody. Special cases. It's not common. Most stories, like anonymous sourcing is your last resort.
Right.
And then only if they're at risk and there's a real cause for it. And also, the journalist and the institution are vouching for that anonymous source. Right? So they're saying we stake our reputation on this anonymity. And that got twisted when we got online because, well, mostly because of people building the tech had never worked in a newspaper and didn't know how anonymity worked.
Right.
But they're like, oh, well, if we can have anonymous media, then we can have, you know, people be anonymous online. But what they did is they completely removed any attempted accountability, any possible chance of accountability. And when people are completely unaccountable, they act like jerks, you know?
Right.
And so what we've done – and then again, that got conflated with free speech. Like anonymity means free speech. And the examples people say, well, if somebody wants to be a whistleblower, they have to be anonymous. But you look at how whistleblowing happens in media, and they're not anonymous to the journalist.
Right.
The journalist knows who they are. They're like, this person came to me and told me the story of this company is dumping chemicals or whatever happens to this company, right? And so they had a misunderstanding of anonymity, which is actually just a method of access to institutions, but with them being the accountability on your behalf. That's what it was in journalism and media in the past. Social media has none of that. So anonymity was just Wild West and whatever you can get away with. And, of course, it gets exploited by people that have the most nefarious goals, the most negative goals, because, like, wow, I get to do stuff and nobody will ever know and I don't ever get held accountable for it. Like, that sounds great.
Right. Nobody's going behind these fake names to be like, I'm going to be a better person than I am in
right,
real life.
Right,
I don't want
right.
anybody to know how great I am.
Exactly. Right. Somebody's like, yeah, I'm just doing Secret Santa for everybody. You know? So like that's that thing where like, we just talked about it in 2 minutes and everybody can understand it. And every reasonable person would be like, yeah, that makes sense. Those are different things. And yet we'd never had that 2 minute conversation on building platforms. And I'm pointing the finger at myself. When I built platforms that let you be anonymous, I was like, man, I totally missed this because I was like, no, I think these are the same thing because they're called the same thing. I didn't know what I didn't know. Now I know better. Now, you know, I run this company Glitch, and it's a place people can build apps. And we think about this stuff all day, every day. Cause like, we're building a community. We're trying to build a social network. We've got millions of people there. And I'm like, man, I am not going to be the one that is going to be creating another place for harassment, another environment where people can be awful to each other. And then, you know, it's funny, but this sounds like wild-eyed optimism now, but I'm like, actually, I think you can encourage people to be good to each other, and they want to be. People want a place where they're like, man, it's not going to be all that drama. It's not going to be all this just tension, that maybe we can do cool, nice things for each other. And there are these little pockets out there on the internet where people are being good to each other, and we just – they get overshadowed because the biggest ones are the worst ones.
All right. Now, I have you here.
Mm-hmm.
I believe you know this about me, but I am a princophile.
Oh, you got to be.
You are a princophile.
Yes,
I don't
sir.
Know if I am quite the princophile that you are, but I can tell you that perhaps the great disappointment of my life is I had tickets to the show in Atlanta that he canceled. And I don't live in Atlanta, right?
Yeah.
So I couldn't go to the next one. Coincidentally, it was the day I wore this t-shirt on Mike and Mike that caused an uproar. And then I get to Atlanta and the show's been canceled.
Right.
But that was my one. So I asked you, how did you meet Prince?
So I did. I never met Prince.
Okay. I misunderstood.
This is complicated. he knew me online. Prince was, even before social media, he was super online. So back in the day, this is early 90s, 94, 95, there was AOL was the network of the day, America Online. There was an AOL chat room, and fans would get together and talk about, you know, whatever Prince was doing. And now keep in mind, for context, he had just changed his name to a symbol. He had just, you know, a couple years before had the biggest record contract ever and then walked away from it. So he was no longer on speaking terms with his own record label. He was – anything, you know, he was only 10 years past having like the biggest album, movie, whatever in the world. So people are like, this boy has lost his mind, like 100%. Like, well, this man has completely gone off the deep edge. And then at that exact same moment, I was like, this is the most interesting thing happening in culture right now. Like, he is talking about another level because he's putting out these songs where he's talking about, like, you can go direct and the internet will let us connect to our fans and you don't need a label and, like, it's all going to be interactive. He put out a CD-ROM. That was the hotness back then.
Yeah,
and
I remember that.
But you're like, this is very digital. And so I was just like, man, he is on another level. He is so far past what people understand. But they all think he's crazy, so nobody's listening to what he's saying. And granted, you know, he would always put it in his, like, purple prose. Like, he would just, like, it wasn't like he was saying it straight out. So
right.
People are like, you have to read between the lines. But if you read between the lines, it was super interesting. So we would go on to these chats and talk about, man, isn't this interesting? And guess who started showing up?
Really?
Yeah. So, and it was always vague. He wasn't like, this is me, whatever. It'd be like a Paisley Park name or something like that. But you knew who it was, and it would be sometimes him, sometimes dudes in the studio with him typing on his behalf. But he was talking to his fans. And I mean, you're talking a chat room with like 30, 40 people. This wasn't a million people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you would ask something. And I remember one example real distinctly that I was like, I know this is him, was, you know, somebody's like, so what are you all doing? And he's like, I'm working on because at that time he was saying Prince is dead.
Right.
I'm not him anymore. So he's like, I'm working on a memorial for Prince of all his greatest hits that we're going to do at the American Music Awards. Dick Clark said I can do this. And we're like, well, what are you talking about? Like, you don't even have a record out. What are you doing? And lo and behold, like 2 weeks later, he went on the AMAs. He did this amazing performance that was like, Prince is dead. Here's the purple medley, the greatest hits. And then here's my new stuff. And it was exactly what he said. It was exact. And you're just like, wow. Okay. This is like, it's verified. This is him. And then he would come like, it was a weekly chat, and it started on Monday nights, and everybody's like, man, this is going too late. Like, I got work tomorrow. So they moved to Sunday nights. I was like, I don't know how that's better, but whatever. And then he put out a song in 96. It was like every Sunday night, I scan my computer looking for somebody to talk to. And so he's just straight up just saying, like, I'm talking to y'all. And he mentioned his AOL handle in the liner notes of the record. And so you're like, okay, this is him. So that was the starting point, was this sense that he was connected to us and he was paying attention. And he knew the names. Like, he knew the people he was talking to. So you fast forward, and he was, like, lurking in on the Prince websites and doing all this stuff. And then he gets to the social media era, and he would do this, like, messing around late at night, tweeting at people, sharing stuff, and then delete them. And, you know, I think it was, one, he was bored and he was a geek and he liked, you know, to play with that stuff. But two, he loved the plausible deniability because he would share information. So it was all over the place. There were fans where, there was a woman I know where like he literally sent her an MP3 of a song he just made. It's like, go put this up on SoundCloud. And she did. And it was out. And then he's like, all right, now take it down. You know, and it was just sort of this, and it was literally like a couple hours it was out. And he would mess with stuff that way because he was just playing. Like he was just sort of having fun. He'd do like caption contests, old photos of himself, like clowning on things. Like it was real human. And so in that moment, this is like getting towards, you know, 2013, 14. It was just such an interesting thing because it was a different side. And he had always had that lens. For 20 years, he spent time online talking to fans. And yet the perception was he was the most unapproachable, most weird, hiding away in Minnesota, you know, kind of guy. But he straight up would talk to us. So long story short, part of this is he put an album out in 09. And he would always make everybody do double duty. So if you're, you know, cleaning the studio as a Paisley Park, you're also the person that was like, you know, engineering the records.
Right.
So this is a guy that was like building the website, but he was also in charge of like arranging performances at Prince's house in LA. Prince was living in LA, mm-hmm. having all those parties and all that. So the guy reaches out to me and he's like, I know you're big into tech. And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, well, I'm building Prince's new website. I was like, that's cool. He's like, and you're a big Prince fan. I was like, yeah. He's like, so Prince wants you to come by the house. So he emails me and he's like, we want to preview the new record and show you the new website and see what you think. And I'm like, yeah, yes, of course, yes. My whole life has been, you know, waiting for this moment. And long story short, they sent the invitation for the day I was supposed to head to Calcutta to go to India for the first time in 25 years for like a family reunion. The whole family was getting back together. I was like, it's literally the only time I can't go. Like I can't go. Like
wow.
I can't change this. And I, you know, it's funny because like I was earlier in my career. Like now I could probably afford to change a ticket, whatever. But I was broke, man. Like I couldn't flight to India. That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
Like, I was like, I can't just eat this change fee or whatever. You know.
Right.
You know. And now I'd put it on the credit card. You know, like I could swing it. And I was like, I can't make it. And I just was like. And this is probably the single greatest thing I've ever said in my life or ever will. I was like, can I get a purple rain check? You know, and Scott, the guy, the web guy was like, you know what? Let me see what I can do. Let's talk when you're back. So, and while we were in India, I got this email, and they were like, listen, you know, that is what it is. I actually found out later that day that I would have been there, Anita Baker was there.
Oh wow!
And they played together for the couple folks that were there. It was like eight people, and Prince joked about making pancakes, and then he and Anita Baker play. And I talked to her later, and I was just like, man, I can't believe I missed you there. But it was, you know, and I was so heartbroken. And then Scott sent me his email, and he was like, listen, Prince does an Oscar party every year. Why don't you come for that? And I'm like, yeah, sign me up. So literally we landed at JFK, come back from India, and then turned around and got right back on the plane and went to LA. And he'd taken over a club. He had a private party there. And it was – I mean, it was Alicia Keys, Taraji Henson. I mean, everybody was there. And I – you know, it was funny because the Scott, the guy that had brought me in – I think he was just having fun, but he's like, oh, you're on the list. You can walk the red carpet. I was like, nobody wants to see me on the red carpet Oscar night. But it was the night that, Slumdog Millionaire won.
Oh, okay.
So I was like, man, this is the best night for Indian people in the history of Hollywood, right? It is like Slumdog won and here I am going to Prince's Oscar party. And it was an incredible show and he played for 3 hours and, you know, and then Scott was like, yeah, he's done. Like, you're not going to get to say hi. That's it, you know. And I was like, you know what?
That's cool.
That's it. You know, I'm good. And so there was that moment. And then after that, Prince clearly knew, like, I was a fan that was visible to him. Not like he knew who right. I was, whatever. But, just like, but also, you know, one of the things that I played with a lot on Twitter was, like, I have a verified account. So you get notifications if I reply or do whatever. It's like I knew he would see it if I responded to stuff. So I was sort of like – play a little bit with like he'd say something and I'd reply back and I know he'd at least see it. So what would happen is he would send messages. So like, you know, one time he shared some link and I was like, man, you already sent that out. Like mm-hmm. you're just trying to gas yourself up because you got a good review. So there's, you know, there's just joking. And like he DM'd me, he was like, seriously? Like that was all he said.
So is this on like the Prince secret account?
No, this was his public account.
The Third Eye Girl
account. Yeah. So it starts Third Eye Girl and he just DM'd me on Third Eye Girl and he was like, seriously? And I was like, the thing is, he didn't follow anybody because he's Prince. So you couldn't reply back. So he could just send you messages, but you couldn't reply back. And I was like, all right. And then another time I was like, man, this, he had some song out. And I was like, man, this is really cool. But like, I was like, yeah, and the vocals don't sound like you on this song. Like, that sounds like, this just sounds different. Like, I don't know if it's a vocoder or whatever, like auto-tune something. And he hit me up. He's like, oh, here's the liner notes for the song. And he's like, this is who was playing the bass. It was like this guy, Goucher, and whatever. And what I realized was, I know these dudes, they have a, like, it's like a Wikipedia, just Prince liner notes, like keep track of what song came out when and all this stuff. So, you want to learn about, like, what show did he play? And he knew I knew them dudes. And he was like, oh, if I send you the liner notes, you'll send it to them. So he was just like, so it was like these little minor things, but that he knew that one, all of us fans were watching and paying attention. And two, that he knew that there were these conduits to controlling his image. It's like, this wouldn't compromise him as the unapproachable magical elf.
Right.
You know, but the liner notes would be right for history. Is that somebody would know, oh, well, on that song, that was actually my backup guy that was singing the vocals, and now you know who played it. And I think that was such a astute, it was so savvy on another level beyond, like, I'm just on social media, but to understand how to use your followers, your fans, to shape, your entire persona. That was real insightful. And for me, that was the same thought he put into the business, into the equity and ownership over his work, into teaching other artists about owning their work. And that was a level of genius every bit as ahead of the curve as everything he did musically and artistically.
Never in my life have I so wanted to be someone who wasn't as tall as me as I am in the moment of hearing all of this. Like, that is, like, man, why was I not hanging out in the AOL chat rooms in the proper ways in 1996 to get this happening? Because I just can't imagine, like, what I would think. Because I'd always, because I heard he had, like, little accounts on the low, and I was like, man, I hope Prince follows me. I'd always wanted if Prince followed me, right? Like, I once saw Dave Chappelle in an elevator, and I hoped he recognized me. He didn't. But I
tell you what, I talked to a woman that did the web streaming. So Prince would, like, stream the rehearsals out of Paisley Park, and you could watch online. And she's like, he would see, and there was a chat underneath, like you see, like on Twitch or whatever, where you see, like, here's the video and underneath these people chatting. And she said, not me, but other fans, she's like, she's like, he would see names and recognize them and be like, oh yeah, that guy doesn't like this song. I mean, straight up knew which fans like which songs because he'd been talking to them for so long online and followed what was happening. And I think that's just another level. And that, so like 100%, like if you had engaged with him on something thoughtful, like he had that respect for people, which, and I think it was in tension with his desire to maintain a mystique. And I think he tried to find a way to balance that where, like, he could still be unapproachable and unknowable, but that he, ultimately, I think, loved connecting with people and loved people that respected the work. And that was, and it was funny because I got clowned for it. The day he died, I was like, we DM'd a couple times, but I never got to meet him. And I was supposed to go up actually to Paisley in the spring after he had passed, and so I had, I just sort of said, we messaged back and forth a couple times, but I never got to go and meet him, and I got all these people dragging me, like, Prince doesn't know who you are, Prince doesn't care. And what I realized was, like, I was so used to, there were so many fans that had talked to him. I mean, his second wife was somebody that had been a fan in the online community, like Manuel, and she's very, very talented, beautiful, smart woman, and, not minimizing that, he loved her and they were married for a reason. But I knew her from, like, she hung out in the chat groups with us for years, and she was like some woman in Toronto. It wasn't like he was 100% connected to that scene. And so I wasn't like, I'm exalted, I know this thing. I was like, he did this with, like, kids, like 19-year-old kids that were fans of his, that he would be like, I'm going to tweet out your music review on your, like, Blogspot blog of my album because I want to help you, like, get known. Like, he would do that as a solid for, like, teenagers that were fans of his. Like, that was the depth there. And I think that thing of, like, like, whatever. Like, I don't have an opinion about Madonna, but, like, I don't think she's like, I know this person in the forum of my fans. I mean? Like, she's not playing in that world. She wasn't sort of existing in that. And I think in the same way that he liked riding his bike around Minneapolis and just interacting with people when he went to the store or to the record store or whatever, I think that idea that he could be human again
after decades of being on this pedestal, I think was really powerful for him.
Yeah, Prince knows you, Cynthia Rose 69.
Right.
Like in the room, right? You know what I mean? Like he's right up there. All right, that is Anil Dash. Gabe says they're about to kick us out of the studio.
All right.
This is CEO of Glitch, man. This has been great. Thank you so much.
I really
appreciate you coming through. And ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for listening to us here on The Right Time. We do this thing a couple times a week. My man Gabe Bassain handles everything behind the scenes. Thank you, sir. Be sure to check us out. Subscribe at the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I am inclined to believe that you are a hater, and we will talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.
The Right Time with Bomani Jones is presented by Goodyear. Drive always discovers possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.